Good afternoon. Hang on. Good morning. I'd like to call to order this Joint Interim Special Committee on Public Education Appropriation for Tuesday, November 14th, 2017. My name is Representative Barbara Smith Warner, and I will be the co-chair chairing the meeting today. And I just wanted to walk through for my colleagues the plan for today's meeting. Historically, the goal has been for this committee to meet twice and then pass its report. I suspect that today we may not pass our report, although I am opening a public hearing and possible work session. Or can I open a possible work session, or can I only open a work session? The plan for today is you have all printed before you, and the members should have received last night the draft of this report based on the October committee meeting that we had. And the plan for today is to have Alicia Miller from the legislative LPRO, because I can never remember what all those letters stand for, except for legislative and office, walk through the report and then take public testimony. We have one person signed up, and we will have that person and then open it up for anyone else as well. And then at the end of that, then we will go through, and then colleagues, I would encourage you all to kind of go through and give your overall commentary. But I would like us to go all the way through with Alethea first and then have our public testifiers, and then we can spend the time. I suspect there will be a lot of comments, edits, etc., which means I doubt we will get it to a form by 12:30, where we will be ready to pass it today. I could be wrong. We could, peace and harmony could fall, an agreement could fall upon all of us. But regardless, we are in public hearing public hearing. So with that, unless you have anything to add as the committee administrator, Ms. Miller? Oh, sorry, Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Based upon your comments that we do have the next meeting, I really would like to participate, and I will not be available except during November.
Okay. We're going to work on the date for that.
Yeah.
Worst case, we may have you participate by phone.
Okay.
If we can't make that happen.
Thank you.
So, any other questions before I call Ms. Miller to the stand? Or any other comments?
There?
Yeah.
Okay.
You might as well.
Yes, I will.
To get your steps in,
yeah.
While you're working today.
No, I'm getting cold.
I believe this
is
on OLIS.
Yes.
For those of you watching along at home or in the building.
For the record, my name's Alethea Miller with the Legislative Policy Research Office, known as LPRO. So for this report, I'll be presenting the first and the last part, and then we're going to have the fiscal officer, Doug Wilson, who's also in the room, present the middle section related to the fiscal aspect. So for the record, my name's Alethea Miller. Thank you for having me here today, co-chairs Monroe and Smith-Warner, members of the committee. So I'll start by just walking you through the report. So
Mr. Co-Chair.
Yeah.
You feeling better today?
I am.
You were pretty sick last week.
I was very sick. I'm hoping I didn't give it to Representative Wisnett. So when I heard him earlier in House Ed, I thought, oh no. So I hope it wasn't from me. Yes, I am feeling better.
Thank you. That's good.
So I'll start by walking everyone through the report. So we'll just start off with page 2, which is the first page after the cover page. So that's essentially the text from the ballot measure, the Oregon revised statutes, and the legal case, which was Pendleton School District versus the State of Oregon, which was in the year 2008, and it essentially ruled that. So the conclusion was that in adopting Article 8, Section 8, Oregon voters did not intend to achieve the level of funding required in the constitutional provision through the judicial enforcement. So, which is why we're here today. We're doing the report, and the legislature is not required to fully fund education. They're required to in the Constitution, but if they don't, either way, we have to do the report.
Okay.
Go through. No. So then I'll go on to page 3. So page 3 is just the definition of the quality goals and the statutory charge for the Quality Education Commission. Pretty standard language. We discussed it the last meeting. It was in the PowerPoint. Shouldn't be anything too abnormal. And we've had this consistently these last two pages in the last 5 to 7 reports. So next I'll talk to you about page 4. So page 4 is specific to the Quality Education Commission and their recommendations. They recommend that education is funded fully. So K-12 is funded at the full level. But if the legislature is not able to, they also have two alternative suggestions. The first one is to phase in full funding over 10 years, which is 5 biennia. This has been the suggestion in the last reports as well, so that's a standard suggestion. We have not been able to do that to present day. And then the second alternative is to increase funding for pre-K programs and full-day kindergartens. This is a new alternative that's been added to the Quality Education Commission report, but it's an alternative that we have in our report, as indicated by them. And then next I'll move on to page 5. So the Quality Education Commission has a best practices panel, which has made additional recommendations. So those three recommendations, the first one is to continue to explore new strategies in successful schools and alternatives to graduation. The second recommendation was to use a statewide survey of Oregon teachers. And the third recommendation was to implement the next phase of best practices for high schools, community college, and four-year colleges, which is really to maneuver towards career technical education and to bolster that. So next we're going to move into how the measures are being used to identify the progress toward quality goals. So if you look at the exhibits 1 and 3, which are on pages 6 and 7, those specifically reflect the average score for Oregon students in math and reading. So you can see those. That's exhibit 1, which is math, which is the average RIT score. And the language specific to RIT, that is a raw score students receive on the assessment, which the Oregon Department of Education has indicated is the average RIT score is a more comparable measure, which is why they have moved towards using that particular score. So you can see that in exhibits 1 and 3. For exhibit 2, which is on page 7, specifically 2 and 4, which are on pages 7 and 8, that's the percentage of students meeting or exceeding math and reading score. So the state of Oregon moved from the Oregon Assessment of Knowledge and Skills, which is known as the OAKS test, to SBAC, which is Smarter Balanced. And essentially the standards have changed. So for SBAC, we're not able to easily compare the actual standards and the assessments. This was something, my understanding is, this was something that had been presented to the legislature previously about the fact that by moving from the OAKS test to SBAC, there was a concern that our scores would drop. And so this is essentially what happened. And the reason why is because that standard has changed, so the assessment has. So as you can see, from those charts, it was in 2013-14, which is when 2014-15, which is when we ended up adopting the SBAC and moved away from the OAKS test, and then because the system has changed, that's why now there's a drop. And so then for pages. For pages 9 and 10, those represent trends in high school graduation data. So some conclusions that you can draw from exhibits 5, 6, 7, and 8 are that the gender gap has remained unchanged in graduation. There's a gap between those students who are considered economically disadvantaged and disadvantaged students is increasing, or economically advantaged and disadvantaged students is increasing. And then students with disabilities graduate on time with considerably lower rates compared to students without disabilities. So that's the end part of my section, and then Doug's going to talk about the K through 12 appropriation for 2017-18. Thank you.
Good
Greetings, Mr. Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, legislative fiscal staff, Doug Wilson. On page 11 is just a table that presents sort of the resources. I should note that, and we'll probably add a footnote to this effect, that there are new estimates, and I term estimates again for local revenues, that are slightly higher than are listed here in the adopted budget. I'll probably suggest adding a footnote just because the figures that you see on this page are what we've used across all our publications and what was assumed sort of during session. But there are new estimates that increase the local property taxes by a little bit. So I will note that with a footnote. Going on, basically the next few pages are those charts with some text that I showed you or presented to you whenever the last meeting was a few weeks ago. I will say that as you go through these, that we will, in the final report, fix some of the labels that someone, or at least some of you, had trouble reading because they were too small, and also probably try to standardize the number of decimal places, because you'll notice that are another, you know, in some places we're saying 1.653 million, in other places we're saying 1.6. We'll try to standardize that in the final report also. But I don't think the content changes, and I won't go through these individually. But what you see are there are the amount of the total state general fund and lottery fund budgets, that division just within education, how the state school formula, which is really what you're talking about, the state school fund portion or that state portion of the total formula revenues, which are property, which are local revenues, and the state school fund representing state levels there on page 14, and the changes over time also on page 14. Page 15 sort of lays out the distribution of that formula revenue. You'll notice that, as I noted, that over 99% are distributed directly to school districts. The top listing there on page 15 represents less than 1%, but most of it goes to either for students that aren't part of school district services, long-term care, school for the deaf, those kinds of things, or funding that is distributed to school districts after it is quote-unquote carved out, things like the English language learners and those types of programs. Then page 16 just notes that there are other sources of funding or other appropriations made in the state budget for other types of school or K-12 programs. These are sometimes referred to as grant and aid. Again, most of that is distributed out to school districts as part of grant payments or formula payments. So that leaves us you on page 17. I don't know if you want to comment on this one.
Page 17 is the sufficiency determination. So essentially, if you're going for the adopted budget, it includes an appropriation of $8.2 billion, which results in a gap of $1.77 billion, and that's different than what was provided in the whole report for the Quality Education Commission. And the reason why is because their original estimate was based on it was prior to the adopted budget. So if you compare those, you'll notice it's always off. That's the historical precedent. And then for that graph, we are going to be editing it so that it looks closer to the one that was provided in the former report, since I know Representative Smith Warner, you had indicated that was an interest and whatnot.
To add the dollar amount of the difference,
yes,
and the percentage as well. Great.
On page 18 are factors leading to insufficiency. There's discussion about revenue growth, what's happened over time in terms of ballot measure 5 and other ballot measures, the impact that the kicker has on revenue trends, as well on top of page 19, some discussion that was pulled out of the executive summary of the most recent economic forecast about sort of what to expect in the relatively near term on economic factors that might happen during the 17-19 biennium forward. So those are things on the revenue side. On the cost drivers, we mention in this draft four major reasons. There may be more, but these are the four that we we have put in at this point. First, number one being sort of a competition for general fund and lottery fund revenues for state government. The examples given here are public safety and the impact of having to incarcerate certain individuals because of ballot measures. Again, ballot measure 11 in this case, and a few, you know, other ballot measures. Health and human services or resources, the demand for those programs, that makes up about 25% of the budget. And there are numerous federal changes that affect the funding levels and funding demand in those areas. And then we also measure, mentioned ballot measure 98 here as a competing factor that added in this budget for 17-19. The legislator appropriated $170 million general fund, which then is competition, in a sense, for resources for the state school fund. Employee compensation is an issue. Employee pay, salary and wages represents roughly 85% of a school district budget. That does have a factor in what decisions are made there. Those decisions are made at the local level and vary from school district to school district in terms of the change from the previous period. PERS, the public employees retirement system, has a major issue or a major factor in the cost as a cost driver. I have included some numbers in there for 15-17 and 17-19 in terms of the amount that is the share of the payroll that goes to PERS. And keep in mind, these are the net rates, and districts, many districts, is also issued pension obligation bonds, which then is another factor in that entire PERS area, but it's more of a local factor than a state factor. And finally, health benefits. Just note that health benefits continue to increase generally above the inflation level.
So next I'll talk to you about the last couple pages. So for page 21, it reports on the impact of insufficiency on the ability to meet the quality goals. So there's text there directly from the QEM report. We've done this in the past because they do a really good job of setting the stage for whether or not, if there were additional money, how would that money alter and specifically help K-12 education. So if there were $361 million additional dollars, it could lower class sizes in elementary schools, more teachers in middle and high schools for $278 million. These are all based on the analyses done in their report as well. Their specific text is, again, in relation to the budget that was originally proposed by the Legislative Assembly, so it was not based on the adopted budget.
And Alethea, those reference on page 28, which is the last page of the report, that's the current IDEA versus prototype. So that kind of shows the costs of covering some of those gaps that are all listed out very thoroughly in that chart on page 28.
Yes.
Is that correct? Not all, but some. And
yes,
that kind of costs those differences out.
Yes.
Is
you mean
correct?
The prototypes for high school,
yep,
middle school? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an Appendix B for reference.
Yep. Oh, gotcha. Great. Pages 26, 27, and 28.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
And then last but not least, talk about the post-secondary quality education goals. That's on page 22. So we discussed this a little bit at the last meeting. So this is the text that we've used in previous years. And it's updated to reflect a House Bill 2311 from this past session that altered 404020 just to make it so that it's specifically for Oregonians that are pursuing education, not all Oregonians. But in relation to where post-secondary plays a role in this report, you know, we'd like to hear, you know, input from the committee as well on this particular topic. So in the past, post-secondary hasn't really been involved in this report. We've always had like a stakeholder come and present. And as you remember from, or as you recall from the last meeting, Ben Cannon from HEC did indicate that funding for public education in higher education is insufficient. So that was their finding. But then on whether or not it should be in the report, it does say that in conversations with sponsors of the legislation for 404020 and legislative council agree that due due to its aspirational nature, it would not establish a quality goal. So if we do not have a quality goal in post-secondary education, then we wouldn't have to measure anything in the report to determine sufficiency. There is no formal letter from Legislative Council. I have reached out and asked about that. So there's no, those were conversations, just so the committee is aware.
Madam Chair, had not brought that up with Alethea, but I went digging last night and this morning to figure out what the Post-Secondary Quality Education Commission was that's mentioned there. I did find one report and an empty Facebook page when I Googled them. The commission did submit a report back in November of 2008. What I'm not clear on is what happened to the model that is at least discussed in this report. So I presently have calls into a couple of staff who have either retired or moved on in other parts of the education sector to find out what actually has happened. But it's pretty certain that any model, if it was developed, was never maintained past that point. So there may be some changes in that language about the commission once we figure get a little more information. I sort of, this is before I did education issues for LFO, and I didn't even know that these folks existed or a model if it does exist.
But you did find the report.
I found the report and an empty Facebook page.
And then just the last couple of pages, it's the appendix. So Appendix A, those are the statutes. They're referenced in the document. And then you also have a copy of the statutes. The committee does. I printed those for everyone. And then also then Appendix B, the prototype schools, which are also referenced in the document.
Okay. Thank you both very much. So as I mentioned before, we'll move on to the testifier who has signed up, as well as open it up to any other testimony, and then we'll move to the legislators for all of you to kind of give your input and talk through as well. So thank you both, and I would like to call Lori Wimmer, please, to the witness table. Is it the witness table? To the stand? I never really know what to call it. The Oregon Education Association.
Yes, thank you, Madam Co-Chair and Mr. Co-Chair. For your record, Lori Wimmer, representing Oregon Education Association's 46,000 members, here to offer a couple of points of congratulations, clarifications, and corrections with respect to this draft, which I tried to speed read. I'd also like to point out that you are here on this committee because we were able to work with the House to make sure that an inadvertent deletion of this committee in 2017 did not occur. So thanks for being here. And thanks to the staff analysts for a very comprehensive report. We always appreciate this. We're probably one of, you know, a handful of people on Earth who actually read it. but I think it's still important to establish a record. We're particularly grateful that the Pendleton et al. Versus the State of Oregon case, which was actually argued in 2008 in October, but the decision was issued on January 23rd by the Supreme Court of 2009. Addressed the sufficiency was corrected. In your last meeting, the statement was made by a testifier that it is the obligation under Article 8, Section 8 for the legislature to either fund schools sufficiently or write a report saying why you didn't. That's not what the court found. The language is on page 2. You'll see it for yourself. It says it shall fund sufficiently and report whether or not you did so, and if not, why not, what the reasons for the insufficiency were. And that "and" and "or" thing is not just a semantic distinction without a difference. It is everything, because the findings did not say you don't have to fund sufficiently. It said that ballot measure 1 in 2000 failed to give the Supreme Court the tools it needed to enforce the decision. So maybe that's a conversation for another day, but it would not be accurate to say that you're off the hook. It's still an expectation in the Constitution, but unfortunately it's a bit of a paper tiger until there's an enforcement mechanism. And certainly no one would be racing to do that until there's a means of getting the revenue needed to be sufficient. So with that said, we wanted to point out a couple of other ideas that we thought ought to go into the report. We agree that though the funding has declined every single year, as a share of our general fund lottery, which was pointed out in the report. It's interesting to note that graduation rates have been improving, and also the achievement gap, the difference among students, has also been narrowing. That's some important good news I thought we would yellow line for you, that even with fewer dollars as adjusted for inflation and other cost drivers, we are doing a little bit better progressively year over year. And all I can say to that is imagine what we could do if we funded sufficiently, how much better a leap forward our students could make. I think it's counterintuitive to say less money equals better results. It's important to remember that more money would equal more exuberant results. Also, other cost drivers that I think are important to put on the record have to do with our students in poverty and our students with high ACEs scores, the trauma-induced experiences that our kids are coming to school with. We are having a crisis around the state of students in classrooms who are coming in with all sorts of emotional health and behavioral struggles that have resulted in injury to themselves, to their classmates, and to their educators. And it is the youngest of kids. You wouldn't think a five-year-old could crack open a head of a teacher, but that's happened in more than one instance in the last year. And so as we have the classroom issues and school safety becomes ever more of an emergency, I expect that those costs will rise as well, because the more we have wraparound services, the better we can address the needs of these kids. We also have increased expectations on the outcome side, and there's a cost factor to that that often doesn't get called out. But I think it's important to note in your report that it's not just a glitch in comparing old test scores to new test scores. It is an expectation that we be much more aggressive about what we want all students to be able to know and do, and how to set their course for their future. And those, too, are costly. The $1.7 billion biennial gap is not due just to Measure 5 either. I'd like to make sure the record reflects that there were three property tax limitation measures in the 90s, not just one, and all three combined to take billions of dollars off the rolls of property value that would otherwise be assessed. And whether or not that was a good or bad outcome, it's just a fact and ought to be in your report. Also, the corporate share has plummeted over the last four decades. In the 70s, it was 18% of the general fund. It's down to somewhere around 6%. So that's a 300% decline. It would seem to me an oversight to leave that out as well. And finally, on page 19, as the cost discussion is being mentioned, it says that employee cost increases being bargained. Well, that's often the case, but it's not always the case. And I will point out to you that in our two recessions of the 2000s, we had teachers working for free for 10 days in Hillsborough and Portland. We had furlough days all over the state. We had all sorts of cost actual reductions and freezes and so on. So it's not always the case that collective bargaining results in increases. And then the last thing I would put on the record is that because we have we are experiencing in urban and rural districts alike teacher shortages in various specialties and substitute teachers and general classroom teachers, those benefit and cost calculations ought to be weighed against the ability to maintain the kind of school system we all want with the expertise at the table when we're having such a difficult time attracting and retaining teachers. So with that, I'll be happy to take your questions.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Yeah, Lori, interesting comment that somehow by this committee doing its job, we might be kind of getting off the hook, I think was what you said. Believe me, I have never and will never feel like I am off the hook until schools are properly funded. And right now, we're nearly $2 billion short.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Just a follow-up to Senator Monroe's thing. I'm obviously sitting in this committee not because I'm an educator, because I'm a revenue earner, and I'm not here because of what we're doing on this committee. So I have a question for you, and I'd like you to take it back to your organization and maybe get back at least to the senators on here, because by the time you get an answer, this committee will have already done this report and will have gone, but I'm sure the House members might be interested in this answer that I want for this question, too. Page 21 of the report lists the impact of insufficiencies on Oregon's ability to meet quality goals. The commission itself has quantified eight or nine recommendations. If the legislature were to magically find in a revenue reform package, so I probably lost a quarter of my voters right now, $361 million for lower class size, and the legislature passed an enabling language, not in Ways and Means, but elsewhere, that said, we're going to give you $361 million extra districts, but you will lower class sizes, and you will spend this $361 million specifically on that. Would your organization be supportive of the items on this list? I'd like you to go back and look and see, I'm not looking for an answer now, and decide which of these your organization would agree are priorities, and if we found the money and the strings are attached, whereas you will do this with this money, whether your organization would support that, before I lose the other 25% of my voters.
So you're, just to clarify, so you're asking about the entire list here?
Okay. Yes, ma'am. That's the list of recommendations that the QEM has, Madam Chair. When this committee passes a report out, it's going to be waved around very shortly and say, this is what we need to fund. And my question to their organization is for the next committee that's going to get this, once we do our job, is are they supportive of these items, and would they support enabling language that says you must spend this money on this? And Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, you'll require, I did ask almost the exact same question of two members of the QEM commission, and they started down the local control thing. And I do understand that, but we need to do things differently if we're going to get Senator Monroe off the hook. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much.
Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, and Senator Boquist, actually, I could answer a part of it at this moment, if you wish, and that is that class size is one of our key issues, and we know that it is a huge problem. It has to be balanced against local control, of course, but we hear you loud and clear, and we also have had our president serve on the Quality Education Commission. Her term of service, I think, ends in January, and then we expect we'll have a new appointee. So we have been a partner in the development of this report that is mentioned in this adequacy report. So the class size issue is huge. Whether or not a particular mandated expenditure is the right approach for getting there versus, say, some of the other options that we've had on the table in the past with respect to class size being bargained down or other kinds of approaches that would enable us to bring down class size as, I mean, it's obviously a key piece of the funding of the quality education model. There are a subset of areas that are the cost drivers that create that adequacy number: class size, full-day kindergarten, sufficient counseling support, and so on. These are the rock star leading indicators of how you get to an optimal education environment, and we're with you.
Madam Vice Chair.
Follow-up, Senator?
I just want to make sure I'm looking for your entity to come back on every one of these line items. Because let's be very clear, there's no secrets out here. I mean, we're talking about trying to do something, and that is imperative. What we have been done and everything we have suggested so far, co-chairs, since Senator Monroe's begun this building and since, Madam Co-Chair, you've been in this building, have not passed. So we have to do something new and novel and different. And so that is why I'm asking the question before a lot of people put a lot of time into trying to figure out how to overhaul the financial system.
Did we not get a copy?
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Senator Rowland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of questions. I do appreciate the fact that you pointed out that the type of students we have is changing and that those have additional costs. One of the issues that has always been a part of this to me is this quality education model and the adequacy of funding is based on a model that expects us to get to what percentage of our total student population?
Co-chairs and Senator Roblin, it was based on an assumption that 90% of students would meet standards, not the 100 that 40-40-20 presumes.
So this basically is saying if we put in approximately $2 billion, we could get to 90%, but not to the 100% that 40-40-20 says. Okay.
That's correct.
I mean, I understand the adequacy issue and why this one is adequate, but that doesn't necessarily mean that that's enough money to get two goals at, say, 100%.
Okay. Other questions for this witness? Okay. Thank you very much. That was the only person who signed up. Is there anyone else here who would like to testify regarding this report? Anyone? Anyone? Okay. Then I'm going to move on to asking for comments and feedback for all of the people on this committee, and I'm happy to go back and forth, House and Senate, whoever raises their hand first. Or I can just go right to Representative Wisnant.
Because we know.
Would you like to start, Representative?
Sure, Madam
okay.
Co-Chair. Thank you. I think we've all read it, but it was late last night. And I had a committee meeting this morning under very good chairmanship that we did get through. He gave me a half an hour to go back and read it. I guess, is Mr. Wilson going to come up, and can we have him?
Do you have some questions for him specifically?
I have several Great. Questions for Mr.
Okay.
Wilson.
Great. And Alethea will be here in case you have any questions for him.
I think
as
the
well.
First question I have, Mrs. Miller, is I should have read the QEM. Does the QEM bill that established it, how does it define funding? What does it define it as funding?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnant, I'm going to actually ask Brian Reeder to come forward since he is the expert on the QEM. I'm definitely not, so because it is a separate commission yeah. staffed by ODE and not by the legislature. Sorry, Brian, for calling you up.
Because, Madam Chair and both co-chairs, my letter I sent to you, I've been working education for 14 years, and I'm very familiar with the QEM, and I think it's a good thing to have. And I've been, even I think Brian's walked me through, and if you do this much money, here's what else you can do and all that good stuff. But I go back to the, you know, to me, it's not just the general fund and lottery fund. And when I look at my work on the Ways and Means Committee under this, most of the people at this table today, it's including property tax and general fund and lottery fund plus other things. So, you know, I gave in my letter, I just pointed out the fact that if you total property tax, which I understand now is going even up higher, if you total property tax and state school fund out of the budget, that we're over what the QEM asked for.
Mr. Reeder.
Co-chair,
can you identify yourself?
I'm sorry, Brian Reeder, Assistant Superintendent in the Office of Research and Data Analysis at the Department of Education. Co-chair Smith Warner, Monroe, Representative Wisnant, I'm not sure I'm following your argument that we're funding schools higher than the QEM.
My question to you, sir, was, Mr. Reeder, was does the QEM bill that established the QEM, does it define what funding is included?
Representative, wasn't it the my understanding of the legislation is that it requires or it defines funding as the level that the state needs to provide once all other funding is taken into account to allow schools to meet our educational goals. So in other words, once we know how much local revenue there is from property taxes and federal revenue there is, and we know how much it costs for school districts to provide a high quality education, how much money is required from the state to get up to that full funding level.
So, Mr. Reed, I respect you a lot, but you're not telling me that the bill defines. Has this committee defined it? Has the Department of Education defined it as general funds and lottery fund? Because that's what we've been doing for all these reports.
So before you answer, Mr. Reeder, I'd just like to clarify. So first of all, it was a ballot measure that established this requirement and to do it through the QEM. So I just want to have that on the record. And second of all, my understanding of what you just said, Mr. Reeder, is that what the Quality Education Commission looks at is how much it would cost for the ideal for the highest quality education, how many resources are there through the other resources, local property tax, etc., and how much it would cost in addition to that from the state in order to get to that number. I believe your concern is, are we in that state number really counting all of the resources that the state is giving that end up going toward education? Is that correct? I'm just trying to make sure that you are asking and he's answering the same question.
Madam Kutcher, I can sign off on a report saying that the funding is insufficient because of cost drivers to meet the QEM standards that they want, okay? But we've got to be level with the people. Property tax was going to be over $4 billion. I mean, it keeps going up. And even if you look at the state, you know, all of us, as I said, sit on the ways and means. If you look at I didn't bring that slide, but if you look at the funding, it's continuously going up. But the problem is the cost drivers. And I think that Mrs. Miller did a pretty good job here. I have some changes recommended for the cost drivers, but she's identified those, and I would probably support OEA's recommendations for other cost drivers that they mentioned to put in there. But we're funding, and the people just got your property tax. Look at your property tax. How much is your property tax? And we talk and talk here about Measure 5 and how it changed so that, you know, now we're responsible for 70% and the property taxes for 30%. We understand all that. But I read all these reports, and it sounds like we failed. But if I look at the amount of money that we gave to K-12, and it was a lot of money, but we have to – I'll go back and analyze how much went to reducing school sizes and how much went to hiring more teachers. Less money. When we're giving them more money, but it's not – you got to go back and compare how much – back 5 years ago, 8 years ago, how much money was not being consumed. I think the only two people that didn't see this was my honorable representative here, Doherty, and I think Broquist. But I have, you know, we had the four-year schools come in, Dr. Ray, and talked about cost drivers. You know, why is tuition still going up? It's the cost drivers. We're giving them more and more money, but it's the cost drivers. So to reach the goals of quality education monitor, we have to address cost. We're not going to be able to create that much more money. So I think we've been for a long time. This is the first time I've served on this committee. I've served on a lot of education. But I think we're not looking at the total amount the citizens of Oregon are contributing to education if you're not including property tax.
So.
Let me let Mr. Reeder go first.
I was just going to ask a clarifying question on that.
Okay, before he answers?
It would help.
Okay, go ahead. Just a moment, please, Mr. Reeder. Senator Roblin.
My question is, at the beginning of the whole process for QEM, do you ever figure out what the total cost of education would be, then subtract out the property tax, subtract out the federal tax, and then look at the last bit of money, which we then work on a quality education model? So do you have a number that you have come up with that is the total cost of education that would satisfy his question before you start looking at just those parts we have control
of? Co-Chair Smith, Warner, and Monroe, Senator Roblin, that's exactly what we do. We establish or we estimate the total cost of delivering high-quality education before we look at the revenue sources at all. And back to Representative Wisnett's point that the amount of funding keeps going up over time, that's true before you adjust for enrollment growth and inflation. Once you make those adjustments, funding has not gone up over time. It's been flat. And it's actually, if you also take into account higher needs students, which have been growing more rapidly than what we call regular students, then funding per student has actually gone down.
Madam Chair, I'm not disagreeing with that statement. It's not in the report. That doesn't say that. You know, we're saying in this report that the legislature did not adequately fund education to meet the quality education model. And I'm disagreeing with that.
Senator Roblin and then Representative Doherty.
So if there was a number that said, this is what we need to spend all funds for quality education, here's what comes from taxes, federal government, here's what comes from the others, the part that quality education model where is the difference. Now what's left over? If we had that in here, would that satisfy you?
Do you read my lunch code?
I did read it. But I'm just trying to figure out.
I said it's insufficient to make Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm, please.
It is insufficient to make QEM goals with the increases in health care and PERS yearly obligations.
Except, I would say that is one line. But to go back to what Mr. Reeder said, there, those are cost drivers. Those are addressed in here, and there are additional ones.
Yeah.
What he said about the higher cost students,
yeah,
about adjusted,
I,
for that. That is all. So all of those cost drivers, I would argue about adding more that specific language. I think that would be very useful to have in this, that specific language that you just had. Let me go to Representative Doherty before I...
Well, I think it's more of a question of, I think what Senator Risnett's getting at is that when you have state funding, it is the same amount weighted. So in other words, you have a certain amount, you have ADMW weighted, and that's what the school district gets. Each school district's property tax is different.
Mm-hmm.
You have got my area, which has got a lot of industry and this kind of thing, and so they get more taxes. There's also one other factor that... If you're saying, let's look at the whole thing, my school district also has a local option. And so we give more money out of our property taxes to our schools than maybe the neighboring district. Yeah. And so I think just the idea of having to be able to come up with one number and saying, this is from the state, this is from the local, and this is actually what people are getting, it's going to vary all over the state. And so maybe that's where some of the confusion is, but... to say yes, if it's this number, then they can fund the entire QEM. The problem is, if there are 198 districts, there are 198 various tax levels. So
okay,
so this 152, right?
Yeah,
Senator Rowland.
So I guess because I think what we do is the right thing, and I just want to make sure that people understand what we do. So our property tax is now equalized for the most part. So everybody pays, yeah, I mean, there are some that get more money from the property tax than would equalize it. Three or four of those school districts that are out there that have more money coming from their property tax than the rest of us get. But the reality is we tend to equalize that. So if you take out all of those things ahead of the time and basically say, we know everybody's getting this, we know everybody's getting this, and then just look at what's left over, i.e. the part that the state needs to fund, and then figure out how that fits into the quality education model, where we're going to get it. That's what we do. I mean, we understand those other monies are there. We understand the federal government gives us money, and every year they figure out what that is, and they subtract it out before they get started, and all that they're looking at is what we, i.e. the legislature, has a responsibility to pay to meet that model. I believe that's what you do.
Mr. Reeder.
Co-Chair Smith Warner and Monroe and Senator Roblin, that's correct. And I guess I would try to state it in a slightly different way to maybe help the understanding, and that is that under Oregon law, there's not a lot of room for local school districts to raise more money through property taxes other than local options. And there's really not much control the state of Oregon has over how much federal money we get for education. So the state is the final funder of education, because the legislature is the only real body that has any control over how much additional money can go for schools under our current law. Now, you could change the law. You could repeal Measures 5 and 50 if you'd like. You could try. But given our property tax law and those limitations, there's really no other place to go for more funding than the legislature. Now, it could be through the state school fund, or it could be through grants outside of the state school fund. It could be a number of different mechanisms, but the state is the only place.
Mr. Wilson, and then I'm going to make a line-specific suggestion that might address some of your concerns. Mr.
Madam
Wilson.
Chair, I would suggest that Alethea and I put some language in here about a little more detail on the QEM, because I think we just accepted. And there is a table in the QEM report, not this report, but the 2016 QEM on page 56, which basically shows sort of what the process is. And it is, the QEM generates a total cost based on the prototype schools and what other factors. It adds in the ESD expenditures and the high cost disabilities costs. And then that is sort of the total funding requirement. It backs out various local revenues, including the local equalization or local option taxes, an estimate of federal revenues, many of which flow through the Department of Education to districts, the PERS side accounts, what we call, and then it also backs out, in this case, almost $4 billion in property taxes. So it comes out with a number of which folks have been talking about the state, what's left over and what the impact is, which really was what the state school fund is to make up that difference. That is the gap. So all the revenue other than that state portion in terms of the formula and costs are factored into that. And I think putting some of that language in the report may help sort of talk about the role of the QEM and how you get to that number. And maybe we need to add a short section.
I would argue that. Actually the top of page, what is right now the top of page 4, which is a two-sentence paragraph, I would argue that perhaps that would be a place that you could add that in. So right now it just says, the QEC report indicated that full funding of the QEM would require an allocation of $9.971 billion to the state school fund, you know, and then it goes right into the alternatives. Perhaps that is where we could have a more thorough explanation based on that, that I hope will cover some of your concerns, and I hope that some others are covered by the further comments that you'll give about cost drivers for here, as well as some of the other testimony that we've had.
Madam Co-Chair, thank you very much for the suggestion and comment. I think my point is that if we're not telling people you're also paying property tax to fund schools, we're not doing it right. Because, you know, and I also had the comment, and we didn't do it, but I understand it because it's a lot of stuff, but, and I think our OEA testifier, who's going to read this? But, you know, if someone does read it and they look at this thing, I think it's important to know that
they have full information.
Full information on what,
yes,
we're, how much
we're
spending.
Presenting full information about the resources that we're spending all across the state.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
I think it's very important that they realize their property taxes paying for it, too.
Sure.
And the equalization. Local property tax. I used to represent Sisters, has a bunch of local property tax. But also we have a Constitution of Oregon that says each student gets equal funding. And that's why we have the 5% limitation on the local. I actually, Representative Buckley asked me, and I supported him adding, Ashland could go 10%. I figured let them tax themselves. They did pass a bill that Ashland could go 10%, but that limit is, you know, go 25 or 20%, because then you don't follow the Constitution, which says each student, no matter where you live in Oregon, gets equal funding for education. So again, I'm not, you know, and again, I think my statement, I think I voted against the Dern education budget because we're not getting more money into schools and into classrooms because of the cost drivers, and we have to address the cost drivers.
Gotcha.
To put more money, larger classes, okay, and things. And I have some other details.
I was going to say, do you want to submit those to Alethea, or are they other comments that you would like to
discuss? I don't know how we're
going to
do as far as suggestions.
I started with you because I know that you have been working very closely on this, and we'll kind of...
I was going to say, I'd just assume you hit those so we can have a conversation about
them. Yes, I agree. So if you want to walk through the report with your other comments as that seem
I think
relevant,
that,
well,
I like,
two of them are here.
I like the report doing, you know, the graduation.
Page.
Oh, I don't have, I don't, let me, this is the charts. Wow. I think it's real important. I have several pages here about.
Yes, you do.
That you know, in higher education, I didn't do this. Mr. Tim Nesbitt's responsible when he was head of the HEC. We're moving in higher education on giving money to the colleges based upon graduation rates, and I'm a supporter of that. It's going to go to the community colleges, too. And these charts, I like the fact that we're focusing not on tests, but graduation rates. So I like that change from the QEM that I had. And, you know, back to my points, the support on page 11, that's when Mr. Wilson has, you know, puts in the local property tax that comes up with that number. Going to, and I think I want to add the cost drivers of the special ed people and the inflation, was that it, or whatever the other ones that Mrs. Wimmer came up with. I think that's really important.
Cost drivers being students in, increase in students in poverty and students with high ACE scores, as well as and that some of the language that Mr.
I'm glad that that Mr. Wilson did put in the pension obligation bonds. I've been working on that for a couple of sessions, and I think that's a real problem for school districts kicking the can down the road on that.
On page
20. I might want to, I'll look at that and see if I can maybe offer a couple of others, make it a little different. On the 21 list, maintenance can't be part of the school state fund. That's one of the lists, is increased maintenance to better maintain buildings, is it?
So page 21, which is a sample of some of the things from the quality education model that they that they do for Ideal Education. So you would argue that that does not necessarily
Well, I don't know. I guess at a certain level there is, but if you go big levels, it can't be part. So. Yeah.
Co-Chair Smith-Warner and Senator Monroe, Representative Wisnett, ongoing maintenance is in the operating budget, and so districts can use.
Okay, we maybe need to define that. It's not it's not putting a roof on a building that got sisters and.
That's correct. They can't use state school fund money for capital projects, but they can for maintenance. You know,
and
regular.
Madam
maintenance.
Chair, the last.
We could footnote that, perhaps, Representative Wisnett.
I think the last one on that page, Madam Co-Chair, is. I like the idea of $31 million for additional summer school. Have we had a bill? Have we seen anything on that?
I know there's my summer learning folks in the back. We will continue to work on that.
Okay.
Yes.
And finally, we talked about it at the last meeting. The comments about higher ed are pretty general, but I'm not sure we want to get it mixed together.
Gotcha. Yeah. I thought... I was as intrigued to learn about the commission as Mr. Wilson was. And I do like, I think we are pretty clear about the fact that 40-40-20 is an aspirational goal. It's not measurable in the same way that QEM is. So it doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to do quite a straight assessment. I feel strongly about the addition of the language with the suggestions from that commission that say these are some of the strategies that should be used. I think that's useful in the same way that the other alternative suggestions were for the K-12 work, and I think that this dovetails with what the HEC certainly has been, a lot of what the work that the HEC and the state has been doing are those lists. So I feel strongly about keeping that language in, even though we don't go further into a dollar for dollar the way that we do on the K-12.
I had one other, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Mr. Wilson, when you, and the cost drivers, you put the percentage, where was that? Okay, it's on page 20. On the PERS, you give the percentage, went from 9.38 to 13.4, which is 4%. I'd like to see an amount of money. I figured it about over $300
million. Madam Chair, there is an estimate that we used in coming up with the current service level, which would be relatively.
But I'm asking, let's put an amount of money, not percentage.
I will attempt to try to get that number to you.
And I would just say, if the number is going to be varying back and forth, I hate to have a number in a report where 1 month it could be this, the next month it could be this. Percentages you can go through and figure out. If you've got a certain dollar amount, that may change every other month. So,
and Madam Chair and members, keep in mind, much of this is almost all of these are estimates, just like the property tax revenue, PERS, which is based on a percentage of whatever
that's
the payroll is. So it varies both by district and statewide, depending at what day almost you're picking. Okay. So
as a co-chair, I would say we can consider that and see if it makes sense within the context of what we're doing, if
Thank
that's
you.
Sufficient.
Thank you very much.
Okay, who's next?
You could actually say approximately.
There we go.
Thank you.
Senator Monroe.
Yes, a couple of things.
I wrote stuff here. That was during
one of the things that always troubles me is when graphs give inaccurate or distorted information. And because we went from Oaks to a new type of test, the graphs that indicate where our students are show a dramatic drop-off in performance that really is not accurate overall.
Request.
The graphs that show our graduation requirements gradually increasing, for example, are accurate, but I would prefer that our report not include, we're all visual learners, not include graphic information that could tend to cause people to misinterpret what has really happened in education. And that's the main one.
If I could make a quick comment or follow up on that, I had kind of made a note in here about the idea of, at a minimum, stopping that graph there and then having another thing rather than drawing the lines to have a better visual representation that we switched from one assessment system to a completely different one. And that I had put a note down to see, and that's only 13-14 or 14-15, whatever it is.
Yeah.
That's 14-15. Even if we had 15-16 to even start to do it as a separate thing. So I agree. I understand your concern, and we had some of that discussion as well. So I would say at a minimum. Are there other feelings about that on the committee?
I can see some critics of education pointing to that and saying, look how bad you're doing.
Yeah, you've plummeted. But it's actually a different assessment system. Yeah. Roblin.
It'll just be a dot because it's one piece of information. Mm-hmm. And I feel comfortable with that. Because I do agree, and I like the way she did it, actually. From my perspective, it was done correctly, because she put the dark line, explained down at the bottom that we're going to a new assessment system. I think that does a good job, but I agree, taking the line away makes you think, oh, it is something new starting, not something connected to the previous. So
great.
I like the idea of just having a dot showing where we are right now and move forward.
Great. Thank you. Senator Monroe, did you have other?
Yeah, one other one is it's whether or not we include higher education in this, and that was not the purpose of it when it was passed back in 2001. Higher education is obviously critical, and we've passed 40-40-20 and so on. Everybody's very concerned about education levels beyond high school, but the QEM is probably not the place to deal with that directly.
Thank you. Anything else? Okay. Representative Doherty?
Nope.
Do you have specific?
Nope.
Okay. Senator Boquist, moving down the table. Do you have any input you would care to share with us in this forum?
Certainly, Madam Co-Chair. And I do have a couple of questions for our good witnesses, or whatever we're calling them out here at this point.
We'll just call them our witnesses.
We'll call them our witnesses. First up, I think I need to do true disclosure. I talked to my two colleagues after the last meeting, because I am, I guess, the wicked witch of the West here in the committee, because I'm the non-educator here, okay? And just checked with them to make sure I knew why I am sitting at this diocese doing education, and then I checked with the presiding officers to make sure I understood why I was sitting at the diocese. And I also informed both of my colleagues that, you know, regardless of what the report says, I'm going to be a no vote. So having done that, let me explain and go back to Mr. Reeder's point here. I agree with Senator Monroe that we need to take higher education out, and there's purpose for that. As Mr. Reeder pointed out earlier, that, you know, good luck going and changing 550, so on and so forth. But I have no idea what's going on in the House of Representatives. Heck, I don't even know what's going on in the Senate these days, by the way. But having said that, I mean, we are going to the only way we're going to undertake page 21, which is the page in which, if you assume a professional model can be developed, and Mr. Wilson could actually quantify what a quality education is in monetary terms and spending. Yeah, I see him. He's pointing his finger. We're going to most likely take a run at this, and my good representative friend from Sun River is wrong. They're going to be waving this piece of paper all over the place when we start this run.
I'm worried about that.
Is that we, in this report, it needs to be definitive of what we know is true, what we believe is professional needs to be aligned, and what we don't know, I would suggest we put assumptions in someplace that says this is what we don't know. This report is going to be used as the basis to attempt to find the funding on page 21. And it will go to the voters, Madam Co-Chair. It will go to the voters. So what we do in this room right here is going to matter. Now, the reason I'm going to vote no in this is to flag the fact that it is a professional model. I can't have anybody define me what is a quality education. Now, I just want everybody to know I got six kids. They've all been through public schools. They've been in a variety of some of the biggest schools and smartest schools in the state. And I have two college degrees I paid for from this state that are out there. But I couldn't tell you if I had to, with a straight face, tell a voter when we're going to increase $2 billion in taxes or we're going to reshuffle after the federal tax code, why we need to spend $361 million in classroom size. Now, I have this fundamental thought that I think that'll work. But as Mr. Reeder pointed out, and his two co-chairs pointed out, there's not a whole lot of real hard science that this is going to work. So I would encourage members, less is more in this particular thing that's right here. And we need to be thinking in front of us. Some of us might be term limited out due to Dr. Pierce before we ever get to a vote of this thing. But having said that, those that are still remaining, we're going to have to explain, if we do some, we're going to explain to people what is a quality education. I see nowhere in the QEM. I read the whole report twice. And I'll admit I told Dr. Reeder and his two colleagues that I had not read it from the last meeting. And so I've read it twice, almost 100 pages. And I've looked for supporting documents, and I've sent questions to Mr. Reeder. I've sent questions to Legislative Revenue Office, and I've now recently, and he doesn't know, copied Mr. Wilson to try and figure out, okay, can we define this? What are the graduation requirements that got us to this point, and how are we going to proceed? This is not status quo. I understand, most of you are educators. You've worked at this. You've argued with us. We've managed to get more money. We don't seem to be, we are making some progress as Senator Monroe is saying, but we're going to have to make a quantum leap, and that quantum leap, just like the transportation package, could easily end up before the voters real fast.
Yeah.
And so what we don't have in front of us, and I don't know whether you educators can, and I know Mr. Wilson won't even stab at this one, is what is a quality education? Madam Co-Chair, I'm pontificating here, not because of what we're going to do in this report, is that we're starting to build the foundation, at least on the Senate side. We're going to take a run at this, even if we have to do it ourselves, I'm told, at trying to come up with a solution to this. And I'm going back to the very basics of saying, at some point, somebody's got to be able to say, what are we to do? Hence my question to Ms. Wimmer back there is if we really came up with $361 million, we all know the reaction at 200 school districts, because they told us that. If we said you can get $261 million and you only spend it on classroom sizes this size right here, they're all going to bow their back. Now, I'm the biggest supporter, supposedly, of local control out there, but after 12 years in this building, I'm now fully aware of the six school districts I've been in. They don't have any local control. That's just fiction. It's total science fiction. The graduation requirements are basically established for all practicality at the state level, and we dictate it down, and the School Board Association makes draft recommendations of all the policies for every district except four or five, and if you don't adopt them, you don't get insured. So there isn't any local control there. Now the question we have is, how are we going to fix it? And so far, no disrespect to the QEM in reading it twice, I don't see the solutions in there to sell it. And I'm really well beyond this committee, Madam Co-Chair, and I did warn my senior colleague here that I had to go down this road because I am sitting on this purely as a revenuer, because we're going to attempt to figure out how to fund whatever it is, and I don't know what it is, that we need to do. So I frankly agree with most everything I've heard here, but I'm going to be a no vote to make sure, and I've told the president's office this, that if we're starting down this road and we're going to make life miserable for the LRO in the back and Mr. Wilson right here for 18 months like you and I served in misery and Rod served in misery on transportation to try and come up with a solution, then we're going to have to really dig in. And I'm a complete novice. I'm the revenuer, and with that, I will shut up, and I don't need to make any other comments. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
I would like to give either one of them an opportunity to respond as well. I just want to say briefly, while I did not write the QEM or any of those reports that they've been doing since 2001, I would just like to point out that the appendix about the basic premise is ideally... Margaret. Here's like the ideal elementary school, how big it is, how many teachers there are, is there ESL, how much the amount of textbooks, how much leadership development. There's leadership development for administrators. There's dedicated teacher collaboration time. That's all prototyped out for an elementary, for a middle school, for a high school, and then compared how much would that cost averaged out over the course of the district. Now, that's a fairly convoluted, that's not a short answer. That's not a narrative answer. I think you could probably do some version of narrative answer, but just in defense of the QEM, I think there is a basis of what is a quality education. And this model is, here would be the ideal elementary, the ideal middle, the ideal high school. Here's how much that would cost versus how much we're spending on it now, or how much we're spending on it now. That is my understanding, just to be clear, because I've only read the QEM report once, but to me, that appendix that's kind of it boiled down in a nutshell. And I don't know if Mr. Reeder has any other comment or explanatory anything about that, but.
Co-chairs Smith, Warner, and Monroe, I would just say I agree with what you just stated, and where I would say the professional judgment comes in is what types of resources are needed in school buildings to bring about a high level of student learning. That's what a quality education, that's how it's defined in my mind, is you listen to the experts, you listen to teachers, you listen to researchers, and what they know from both experience and research to know what works in promoting student learning and what doesn't. And so, you know, we're never going to have an equation that defines what a quality education is. Educating kids is both art and science. And when there's art involved, you listen to the artists, and those are the teachers and the administrators. And that's where the judgment is. And I wouldn't criticize the model because it has some professional judgment involved. There's professional judgment involved in almost everything we do, even in the hard sciences. So, I mean, my comment would be we use the best research we have, and part of that research and part of how you implement that research depends on the judgment of people in the education business.
And I also, just a quick follow-up, I also agree with you on the, you know, from that work on the transportation package, what we discovered is that more and more people like a dedicated fund and a dedicated thing that it's going to. And I agree with you that our biggest concern here continues to be we're underfunding education. We've never come up with a replacement source since Measure 5, 4750. So I agree with you, the premise of we have to figure out what it is that we are going to pitch, that, okay, if we're asking for revenue reform so that we can better or more fully fund education, what is that going to mean? And I agree with you on that, and I think you're right that we need to have a good explanation of what that is. I would reference briefly Measure 98, which where some of the concern was, well, how can we tell districts how to spend this money? Well, we can, and we did. We did a whole rulemaking process with ODE, and each district had to say, this is how we're going to spend it, and get approved. So I would argue, well, those districts' backs might get bowed if we said, here's this much, but this is what you have to do. I think there's precedent for it, and I think potentially that's something you can do. But I did want to acknowledge that I agree with you that I get that there is going to have to be a strong element of that to us figuring out how we are truly going to move this conversation forward, that we need to have concrete things that we can point to that we're going to do.
Madam Co-Chair, I'm either for, neither for or against the QEM. I mean, yeah. I'm ambivalent.
It just is.
It just is.
Like gravity.
Like gravity. And with gravity, right, or in transportation, here's my analogy to maybe try and convey this to the educators. You all know we've lost at the ballot consistently, so let's just cut to the chase there. And we've been doing the QEM for a decade now, and we haven't done much better in terms of other than convincing us legislators that we're doing better. And a few school districts we've done a little bit better. But we need to do a quantum leap if we're going to go forward. If you go out and you build a bridge across the Wilson River in Tillamook, which is all of, you know, 85 foot across, it costs you X, and you know you need to build a bridge like this. If you have to build across the Columbia River, you know it's you need a bigger bridge. We have not been able to convey, and I don't know the answer, frankly, which is why I'm sort of putting this out there. I do not know. You say quality education is a great deal. No, it's not. It's based on what are your graduation requirements, what are we teaching, how much time does it take. Teachers, Democrats and Republicans, talk to me all the time, and they say we got so much crap in the school that we're having to do that has nothing to do with education. We got to change this. I don't know what that is. I do not know what it is. I really don't. The question we're going to have to convince voters of is what is it we're doing, which is, I looked at Mr. Wilson, can you tell me how many science, how many math, how many contact hours, what has to come in to make the equation to get the graduation rate for the quality education? And it's that student and that human being at the bottom. It's how you're familiar with this, Madam Co-Chair. We convince transportation is that your local road is broke. Your local road is broken. Now you admit it. And so it's not on the ballot. That's the sort of direction we're going to have to go. And I am certain somewhere in what Mr. Reeder does, probably not what Mr. Wilson does, but what Mr. Reeder is doing, is somewhere out there, there's a whole bunch of smart people, at least I hope there are, the Department of Education and school districts, who know all these answers, like Mr. Monroe does here, that, you know, you've got to have 126 credits, you've got to have X amount of contact hours, we have to teach reading, writing, and arithmetic, all the rest of this stuff out there, because that is the human factor in which we're going to change the vote to be able to come up with resources. And Madam Co-Chair, I mean, let's face it. We had a governor that wasn't liked by some of the people in this organization, in this room right now, that, you know, when he said, well, maybe we consolidate school districts or maybe we do things differently. In order to get to where we need to go, we're going to have to do things differently, and we're going to have to do it together, which is why I asked the question before. Mr. Reeder wants to deny it at this point. That's fine. To his two good co-chairs and said, well, what happens if we funded $361 million for classroom size and we got this committee on record? Well, there's local control, so on and so forth. And now I've just been informed by a good colleague to the left and listening to you people that we have now performance already in funding in HEC. Maybe I should have voted for the HEC budget instead of against it. Because I don't
part.
Know.
It's a very small.
Yeah, it's very small.
Madam Co-Chair, that's my point here. It's not the report. It's not an attack on QEM. The question is what do we need to do to get the public informed when we don't even understand ourselves? I mean, we might find out in some mechanism that, you know, good Dr. Monroe to the right here is wrong, and that if this class he wanted us to put in the curriculum, if we just took it out, 70% of the population would vote for more funding. Heck, let's take the bloody thing out. We'll put it in later. So there we are, Madam Chair, and I will stop.
Senator Monroe.
And I have a little concern in that I don't believe necessarily that local control is a myth. It doesn't have to be. Often it is, but it doesn't have to be. I represent seven school districts, portions of them. 20 years ago, I was chair of the board of one of those, and I pushed through some reforms through the board. We increased the graduation requirements to the highest in the state, and this is a poor school district, David Douglas. And we also instituted full-day kindergarten way before the rest of the state did. And we also constructed and funded a teen parent program right across from the high school. Those are things that I got done when I was chair of the school board, and had to convince the rest of my school board. I had to convince the good citizens, because we were told that if we raised graduation requirements in a relatively poor district in terms of demographic, that our graduation rate would plummet. It didn't. It went up because if you ask students for more, they will meet what you ask them to do. People like to be challenged. Students, I believe, like to be challenged. So there are things that local school boards can do that make a difference. You're right. Most of them don't ever do those things.
We need 200 extra of you.
Well, I'm getting old.
Not dead yet, Rod.
Thank you, Senator. Other colleagues here? Senator Roland.
I should say something.
You should. It's not a meeting.
I would just say we are fortunate in that the person who was most responsible for the QEM model is still in Oregon, still working hard. His name's David Connolly. He's down at the University of Oregon. He can probably tell you the assumptions that he made, which I agree we need to have. If you understand a model, you have to understand the assumptions that were made to make the model work. QEM, the group, has in fact changed that sum based on the information that comes along every year, and I am impressed with that over the years. They have made improvements, I think, to the model. But I agree, we need to have real conversation about getting down to the bottom of it. The thing that's always been hard about education, because of the way we run it here, is that most people involved in their local school district believe they're doing it right and everybody else is doing it wrong. Education is failing, but it's not failing here. My kid did just fine. Yeah, so
we get reelected.
Exactly. But if we are going to keep moving forward, trying to get the whole state to buy into how do we figure it out. And we're going to have to be pretty clear about if we choose the QOM or whatever model we choose, we have to be able to express it to each other so that we can actually, in common language, explain to people why investing in this is going to happen and make it work. And we're going to have to either get school boards to acknowledge they've got to go along with that because we've all come to this agreement, or maybe less local control. I've always felt I was a high school principal. I had a lot of local control. You know, we could do the things we need to do. We were a long ways away from everybody else. And so, you know, we could work with the teachers. We could get things to go, and we could get and have outstanding results. Did that mean every one of our kids was as successful as we want? No. And having resources and having organizations that said certain kids need more than other kids to get to equity. I mean, there's absolutely no doubt that we have to have a flexible organization at the school level that actually gets the stuff kids need if we want to get to the kind of education we want for every kid. It's not going to cost the same for every kid, and I think the model tries to work on that in some ways. So I look forward to the opportunity to try to get something out to people that they could say, yeah, this is what we want and this is where we're going to go. But it is going to take a lot of work, and it's going to require us to be able to explain exactly what we did, which I think, to the credit of the transportation people, there was the group that was there doing the work, not those of us that were sitting back waiting for the answer, when asked, they could all answer questions pretty detailed about why this is important, what it was going to do, and why they chose this option, because they had looked at a lot of options before they came to the one that they did. So I agree that same kind of detailed information and knowledge is going to be important for any move forward to try to answer the question that you're pointing out on that page 20.
Thank you.
I really wanted to say that this round of conversations with regard to this report is the best I've ever been involved with.
Yeah.
Because I've been involved before.
No, that's right. I have too.
And I will say our staff has done an exceptional job in bringing information together. I appreciate the people who have come to testify, because we haven't had this conversation in the past, and it's necessary if we're going to do the next step. So I thank everybody for that.
Thank you. And I would just like to say something that I try to say every day, which is that equity is not equality.
That's right.
Is one of the most important things and the least understood thing. Equity does not mean everybody gets the same. It means people who need less get less, and people who need more get more.
Means that outcomes,
correct,
are the things we're looking for.
Is what
is
you're
exactly
tying into.
What
mm-hmm. So my only, I just want to, I had only, I don't think any, I had any comments on this that weren't mostly covered, except making sure, and I think it was in the OEA presentation about the cost of assessments being another cost driver. Mm-hmm. I believe that was already brought up. I have a couple little editing tweaks. But beyond that, I think it's all been covered. My only question now is, so the broad work we've kind of come to on this, besides the question about the changing in the graphs, expanding some of the cost drivers, expanding the explanation of that page 4 item about QEM, how you get there, and might I add perhaps some brief narrative of what a quality, and I don't want to make this into any more of a doctoral dissertation than it already is, but perhaps some narrative description of even high goals of what a quality education is, and I'm not sure what that is. So now my question is, it is 12:29, we have 1 minute left in this committee hearing, and on the one hand, I think we have some folks who've already said how they're going to vote on this or not. So there is an argument to be made that we could vote on it now, even though it is not complete, and our work would be done. Or we could indeed have another meeting at which we're not sure everyone will be able to come, and therefore you would not be able to vote necessarily. I don't know if we'll get, I know that December is bad for you. I don't know that with what we're asking the staff to do that they could get it done. Given the Thanksgiving and stuff coming up.
What's our
up.
Deadline on this?
We have to be 180 days after signing die,
which is like the first week of January.
Yeah.
Which is
so,
what?
First week of January.
Okay.
So we indeed can go to, I want to both maximize, both get done within our deadline and also maximize committee participation, but also not ask you all to vote on something that is going to have not significant rewrites, but substantive additions and changes. So,
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Wisnett.
Yes. We don't have a minority report, right, on this? We don't.
No.
Okay. I'd like to wait. I think my objective, as I said, was let's be sure that that gets done. And I would like to work with Mr. Wilson. I'll be glad to draft some language and submit to you and him.
Okay.
For the efficiency, that one paragraph on this we start off with. And then the other things I'm okay with.
Okay. Representative.
And my question is, if we're 1 week late, in other words, come back on the next interim days, what is, are they going to take us?
I don't believe we're going to be arrested. But indeed, it's probably not a good precedent
okay.
that it's 180 days. So
so what could we meet January 2nd or 3rd?
I was going to say, I would argue that there seems to be consensus we're not going to vote on it today. We're going to resubmit specific proposals and schedule a final meeting at which we will have a brief review and a vote. We will schedule that so that the maximum number of committee members can attend.
Yeah.
I think we can also see it by phone, right?
We're trying to clarify the attendance by phone.
Yeah.
Except in exceptional cases, I am told, it is not standard practice to allow committee members to attend and therefore vote by phone unless it's extraordinary circumstances. I don't know if we are the determiners of extraordinary circumstances, but we will work to make it between our very competent staff. I know that we will and I know that we will do the best we can to let as many people as possible participate. Senator,
I would say that I think we have been explicit enough for staff to actually come up with something that I will feel comfortable with. I feel pretty good about that. So I am willing, if you want to vote today, I'm willing to vote today.
Okay.
But and that's only because I think the conversation has been rich enough that people they understand what they're being asked to do. And it's not going to change the essence of this much. I mean, all of them are clarifications. None of them are changing what we're going to do on this. We're going to end up saying that we didn't have enough money to meet the needs of this deal, and therefore we agree. The issues are the particulars on what we're saying in it, and so I'm okay with today, if in fact that works. And I would like anybody who wants to write the other stuff, because the outcome, the final thing that we're really voting on, I don't think it's going to change.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Boquist.
I don't disagree with Senator Roblin but on his substantive argument, but I do disagree with him on his political argument. I'm almost assuming, after my spiel that has just come out, that everybody in the OEA is going to know what I had to say here in a few minutes. And Mr. Reeder and other people are going to make sure every school board association knows. And that's exactly what we want to message the NSN. We want everybody
that's
to know. It is not business as usual. We're not just going to rubber stamp this thing and send it to its deathbed, at least
that's
on the
right.
Senate side, because our instructions have been very clear. I mean, we're intending to try and figure out what to do, which is an effort, you know, of as large as the transportation package. And so I think waiting to let people, you know, so that the food chain out there and the email chain can start firing messages out there that these clowns in Salem are going to do something, we all better sit up and pay attention to what's going on. And that could do nothing but help all of us, because I don't think there's a single member here or anybody in the room who doesn't agree we need to have a quality education. Some of us can't define it, and we don't know how to fund it, but we at least all agree that's what we need to do. And I think waiting will give the opportunity for the food chain and the flash book and the social media and all the rest of that stuff to go out there and say, hey, somebody better sit out there up in the 200 districts that are out there and pay attention, because something's about to happen.
198.
First and second week of December is fine.
I was going to say, so I'm going to take the prerogative of the gavel and say, indeed, we will come up with a third and final meeting time. We will schedule it for maximum participation. And with that, yes, Representative Wisnik.
Did we decide to ask the drafters to take out the higher education?
I believe that the way we have it, which is in it, we say we do not have things to model this against, and so we are not. I am comfortable with the way that it is in there and not asking for further, and basically saying, while this is in the ballot measure, we don't believe we have a thing. But
Madam Chair, members, I was just going to point out ORS 171.857, which is on the page 2, basically requires you to at least address
it. To have at least
that
line that acknowledges it. So, okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, all testifiers. Thank you, colleagues. With that, we're adjourned. Thank you, colleagues. With that, we're adjourned.